This podcast is from the Kentucky Women Writers Conference, made possible by the University of Kentucky in Lexington. In this talk, the playwright Naomi Wallace discusses coming of age as a writer in Kentucky. It is entitled Big History Small: Resistance, Hospitality, and Writing for American Theater.
So, this afternoon I'd like to speak about notions of hospitality and history in terms of theater today, about languages of war and engaged writing for the theater. Then I'm going to mix these notions together, give them a good shake, and hope for spontaneous combustion. And if that's too optimistic, then perhaps some interesting coagulations. But I'd like to speak more personally to you today, something I am not in the habit of doing. Not because I am shy, but because, to put it simply, I prefer to speak of the lives of others rather than my own. For one, they're more compelling, but also because to speak from the eye can lead to myopia. This is not a case of subjectivity versus objectivity, the eye versus accurately representing the other. I am arguing for a worlding of subjecthood. In other words, linking how we see ourselves and our neighborhoods with how we see strangers across the world. In thinking about hospitality, we'll need to consider whom we welcome onto the stage and how our writing might cross the divide between our own personal experience and that of others. From our own sexuality to that of another sexuality, from our own race to that of another race, our own class and gender to that of another class and gender. Hospitality plays an important role in Shakespeare. One of drama's worst hosts, Macbeth, is thus because of his appetite for self-serving power. While a victim of inhospitable forces, King Lear comes to disregard power and embrace the visitor as well as a more egalitarian world. Expose thyself to feel what wretches feel, that thou may shake the superflux to them and show the heavens more just. All writing for the theater is in some sense an act of violation. By this I mean that when we enter into the lives of others and try to imagine a perspective that is not our own, we have to push through what we know, what we are sure of, what we value. Push into the very skin of another life and vision. Sure, that's common sense for a writer, but in general, mainstream American theater more often than not does not enter into the lives and bodies of those we consider strangers, but rather bounces off the barriers, contenting itself with the safe and recycled materials of stereotype, albeit refreshed for the present moment, cliche and hearsay. Writing that does not actually violate boundaries, that does not enter into the process of trespass, is often a writing that is safe, consumable, and shallow. A theater that does not challenge its own assumptions, its own ignorance, with curiosity and humility, is a contracted theater, a diminished theater. And in these harsh and difficult days, when we're afraid of losing what we have, afraid of losing what we almost had, afraid of getting what we've always feared, we make choices. Artists make choices about who enters their stage, who gets the light and who gets only a glancing view, who stays around and has the last word, the best word, and who is at the center of the joke, the center of love or humiliation. We are encouraged to fear the outsider, the one at the edge of our stage, the inspector at the door. And here I am not summoning the overly esoteric otherness of Emmanuel Levinas, the stranger who shatters and consumes us, but rather to note the ones who enter the landscape of our stage and the ones who are refused its geography. If, as Terry Eagleton says, neighborhood is a practice rather than a locality, we must investigate the neighborhoods of our theater and highlight what is invisible, who is missing, who is spoken for, and who is unmentionable. How does the policing of these neighborhoods on stage through ourselves and our institutions perpetuate a retracted, redacted, and inhospitable theater? Coming into stories that we are not familiar with, entering into bodies and genders that are not our own is a risk and a responsibility that I believe is often taken too lightly. For example, white playwrights over many decades have rarely given a second thought to creating characters for Black Americans. Our conscious and unconscious sense of entitlement, our skin privilege, our general and often nursed ignorance has created a legacy of demeaning, shallow, and stereotypical portraits of African Americans and other people of color on stage. Considering the damage that white writers have done, one might come to the conclusion that it's best for white writers to stick with writing for white folks. Too much damage otherwise. And yet I believe that all of us must take the risk to represent anyone and everyone. But why focus on imagination and its power to violate and trespass? Am I not in danger of advocating a sort of colonialization, given that violation also signifies the oppression of one by another? Why not stick with what we know? Write about what we know. Well, certainly there is a place for that, an important place, especially for the stories of those artists and their communities who have not been welcomed onto the American stage, but who have had to forge a space for themselves there. Black artists, Asian, Latino, Native American, Arab American, others, and working class workers of all colors. However, mainstream American theater is still largely a white middle class endeavor. And in being so is not really an American theater, but a specialized illusionary theater. So how do we pillage the material of our own lives to find our connection to the larger historical and social forces swirling around our heads, if not inside them? The important word here is find rather than create, because these connections already exist. The goal is to uncover these live wires, no matter how buried or twisted they are. The trick is to tap into these lines and charge up our imaginations. First, let us recall that hospitality derives from the Latin hospitare, to entertain. This neatly encapsulates the type of theater I believe we strive for, one that gives, that offers pleasure and nourishment, but it is also a theater of consideration that is open to ideas, others, ourselves. The tradition of the unexpected guest who provokes a revelation, if not a reconfiguration of the familiar, is well worn. But as in J.B. Priestley's The Inspector Calls, I would like to take this tradition a step further. The other and ourselves should not be seen as the foreign facing off against the familiar. As the inspector shows, we already know the unknown, even if we didn't know we knew it. Shades of Donald Rumsfeld there, apologies. My point is this. We are already and always complicit, interconnected, and related to the stranger, the other, the unfamiliar. I grew up in Kentucky. Unlike most Kentuckians, I grew up with privilege. My father was a journalist and, as he liked to refer to himself, a gentleman farmer. I was raised on a small cattle farm, which, while rarely breaking even, was kept going by the sizable inheritance bestowed on my father. Though my mother, Sonia, was Dutch working class, and it was she who trained me in class consciousness, I grew up in an idyllic pastoral landscape. But over the hill and not so far away, there lived two different communities. One was white working class and the other Black working class. As a young child, these were my neighbors. I slept in their houses. I ran with their children. I kissed their boys. I fell in love with their girls. But the most fruitful thing I did was shut my mouth in the presence of the adults of these families, and I listened. I listened to their dinner chat, their courtesies, their hopes, the vulnerability of their fears that they exposed to me, because as long as I was a child, I was still harmless. I hadn't yet stepped into my full privileges of class and skin. And it was here that I learned most intimately about the magic and seduction of the American dream. Well, in one of these communities over the hill, I found a pickup driving boyfriend named Jay. Now, Jay's father had fought in Korea, and he'd been poisoned by the tin food rations that were distributed by the U.S. government to troops during the war. The poison had corroded his lungs. He started with two lungs. Then he had one removed, then another half. He was left to breathe with half a lung. But this man, Mr. Aldridge, continued to work. I remember a few years later, when I'd lost contact with both Jay and his family, stopping by the local restaurant. There I saw Mr. Aldridge sitting in the corner with a paper cup of coffee and a cigarette. I was still a reasonably polite young woman, so I sat with him a few moments to say hello. Already then, he was dying, but he did his best to hide it. But he asked me a question that I have never forgotten. He said, "How is it that I have worked hard all my life and still I have nothing?" I didn't have an answer. My own father had two lungs, and we didn't have nothing. We had lots of things. I can recall that moment easily and yet still not without unease. Mr. Aldridge must have been in his 40s when he started his dying. He was a handsome man. Years later, I heard he suffocated to death on what was left of his lung. His son Jay found him. Jay tried to resuscitate his father with mouth to mouth for 3 hours, long after he was dead. Jay himself never got over his father's death, which was both an economic and physical suffocation. I have not seen Jay for decades. I hear he speaks to invisible beings and lives on the streets. Mr. Aldridge worked for his family all his life. He died broke, and he left a broken family behind him because of it. To this day, our government continues to deny its culpability for the poisoning of its own troops. Of course, when Mr. Aldridge asked me that question in the restaurant, I was still only a teenager. I was interested in Bacardi and boys, Harrod's Creek and field parties where we danced on the hoods of banged-up trucks. While some sense of discomfort lived within me, I thought neither long nor hard about Mr. Aldridge's question, not until many years later. We are responsible for the education of our imaginations, for its focus and direction. We must ask ourselves, whom does my imagination serve? What does my imagination serve? Where will I urge my mind to venture and roam? And to what purpose? Is the stage I create the antithesis of hospitality, an apology for the delectables of rampant consumerism? As Edward Bond in his Theater Poems and Songs puts it, how is society organized? For the happiness of the people, or so that profit can be drawn at as many points as possible? Angela Tucker. A name that naturally has no meaning to those of you here, but one that was central to my childhood. Angela lived next door to our cattle farm in Prospect, Kentucky, and we began our friendship when we were both the tender age of 5 or 6. We two girls, one black and one white, went fishing together, swimming in the pond together, naked at night, riding ponies and creaking together, and I'm ashamed to say when we were 12, stealing together. In our excited state of thievery, we roamed our sparse neighborhood during the late afternoon when most people were still at work. We did little harm, though a few times we each left with a small bulge in our pocket, a toy, a pair of gloves, or sometimes even a piece of jewelry. Mostly we stumbled giggling from room to room, our adrenaline pitched so high we could hear it, brushing up against the things of others. Their musty adult clothes, their smoothed sheets, the knick-knacks and thingamajigs of other lives passing like magic through our hands. Angela and I never played Follow the Leader because in our limited gaze, we were equals. Though in Kentucky then and Kentucky now, we were for all intents and purposes an interracial friendship of wildness, small-scale criminality, and secrets. The only imbalance was the thievery. That was my idea. Though Angela followed me in as best friends do. Luck liked us, however, for a kindly neighbor reported our acts to my father one day, and he confronted us without punishment, but with such grave disappointment in our behavior that neither of us would thieve again, at least not for many years. As we grew into teenagers, I dreamed to be a jockey and a writer, Angela to be a flight attendant. I would keep in things in order on the racetrack and on the page. Angela would handle the sky. And so off I went to college up east while Angela applied to the airlines, who one after another said no and no and no thanks. For a variety of reasons, the most unsaid reason in 1970 Kentucky being her blackness. Meanwhile, the ticket of privilege I carried had less to do with my intellect or talent and more to do with my whiteness and class power. And this cultural capital continued to open doors that were as invisible to me as the air I breathed. I bathed in education and welcoming degrees. Angela stayed in Kentucky, grappling with one of the most oppressive class systems in the world, moving from checkout job to quick stop joint, and of course, working in a nursing home and wiping the asses of the deranged and or dying well-to-do of Louisville. And as the possibility of being airborne receded from Angela's life, I flew to Europe to study the classics and whatever else crossed my path. Occasionally, I even worked hard. I knew what that term meant, working hard, because I learned it from her. Had I been in Angela's shoes, I doubt I would have lasted as long as she lasted, managing to stay positive and dream within a system that grinds down and pulverizes the humanity of so many laboring bodies. The last time I saw Angela Tucker, 25 years had passed since we were children. As a young woman, Angela was smart, friendly, and beautiful. The perfect criteria for working inside your average flying machine with a maximum takeoff weight of 351,000 pounds. She came to my door now almost a stranger. Her two children had been removed from her care, and she was stooped and wanned under the burden of overwork and various addictions. We spoke only briefly, but somewhere in our stilted conversation, I told her she was wrong when she said, "You left me behind." Like the question Jay's father asked me, Angela's words have kept a part of me in a perpetual state of what I term enhauntment, perhaps as opposed to contentment or fulfillment. What these childhood friendships relayed to me is that there is something seriously and morally wrong with an economic system that nurtures the few rich and powerful and diminishes and devours the rest. It is not for lack of effort, willpower, or moral fiber that so many have been left broken, impoverished, and afraid, but the fault of a racist and classist social system designed to have the majority struggling and a minority living in the lap of luxury. I saw Angela's brother Maurice last summer. He told me that his sister now lives in an underpass in downtown Louisville. She is in and out of jail. I travel to universities and colleges to talk about writing and resistance. Angela sleeps under bridges among other unruly passengers of the capitalist dream, still waiting for their flights to be called. Again, I come back to the question, how do we resist the temptation to write it safe? How do we as artists engage with the most urgent questions of our time? With oppression and injustice here within our own turbulent home, how do we engage with war? As writers, we need, I would suggest, to become detectives, inspectors, and investigators into our own privilege and power, our culpability, our closing the door. When we write, we can investigate the unseen, the disremembered. We can cultivate a hospitality toward dissent rather than a nurtured contempt for the truth. We can do the hard work of inquiring into history, both immediate and past, both near and remote, with seriousness, imaginative thinking, playfulness, curiosity, and a ruthless, carnivalesque sense of hope. We must do research. If possible, we travel and talk to others. We read and read and digest and consider. We get involved. We imagine. We imagine some more. We listen. And then, if we're lucky, we write. Let me be clear. There are 1,000 ways we can trip and flounder when we engage in writing about experiences far from our own. We might fail to honor the complicated humanity of another. We might find that cliché sneaks into our path, and we stand on it and build from there. We might simply miss the boat. To aid us in this challenge, we might stay alert to the corrective that Edward Said suggests in his Humanism and Democratic Criticism. And here I will substitute the word playwright for intellectual, for we are both. The playwright or writer should be a kind of counter-memory, with his or her own counter-discourse that will not allow conscience to look away or fall asleep. The best corrective is to imagine the person you are discussing or writing about, in this case, the person on whom the bombs will fall, reading you in your presence. We live in increasingly inhospitable times. Fanning anti-immigrant hysteria and increasing attacks on women's health are part and parcel of the voracious and conservative status quo program, which distorts our understanding of the world and our place in it, and is hurriedly dismantling civic society, undermining our libraries, disappearing our public spaces, threatening our schools and the right to free education, all the necessary public places where we fall in love with the world and one another, free from the fundamentalism of the profit motive. Inhospitality is about tending one's own garden and locking the gate. It's about greed and fear, NIMBYism as life philosophy. Mainstream culture suffocates our awareness of the inherent connection, however tenuous, between you and I, between Los Angeles and Afghanistan, between Kentucky and Sudan, Jenin and New York, between Pakistan and Cleveland. The poet Randall Jarrell, in his poem Losses, sums up this notion. In bombers named for girls, we burned the cities we had learned about in school till our lives gave out, our bodies lay among the people we had killed and never seen. The pilot knows that there is a thread, a wire, connecting his or her experience to those beneath the bomber. This was exactly the coming to conscience that turned the late Howard Zinn into both a pacifist and groundbreaking historian activist. The pilot and the bomb. But what does this have to do with those of us who are neither the pilot nor the bombed? Our connection is actually terribly intimate. And we might begin our investigation of this link, for instance, with bodily fluid, sweat, produced by labor, a good day's labor. We work, all of us, we care about our work. We are citizens, we pay taxes, so I speak to you here because I want to be of use. We all want to be of use, and the fruit of our labor is to see our loved ones bloom. But the fruit of our labor also goes to kill others like you. The bombs we have paid for, the aircraft we have assembled, the napalm we have sweat for. This is the painful and heartbreaking contradiction of living in this culture and this society. How do we open out to these contradictions so that they inspire us rather than cripple us? We might begin with curiosity. For example, in this country, our labor is harnessed in the manufacturing of the near-lethal tear gas created in Pennsylvania, courtesy of Combine, and used in Egypt, in other Middle Eastern countries, and the illegally occupied Palestinian territories. Our toil and grind is exploited to build F-16s and Apache helicopters, depleted uranium, and cluster munitions. Curiosity. What is our part in the brutal and lawless killing in 2009 of over 1,200 Gazan civilians, 280 of which were children trapped in the largest open-air prison in the world? How might we begin to imagine the well-documented and systematic violence and torture inside Israeli prisons? To envision the lives of civilians who live in fear and under the shadow of the fruits of a fruitless Middle East peace plan that has to be, in the words of Sarah Roy, one of the most spectacular deceptions in modern history. Curiosity, object, what is the story? Let us look at white phosphorus. How might we write about white phosphorus? How might we find a way in? It makes a beautiful sound when you say it out loud, white phosphorus. Recently, it has been used as a weapon, and when it was originally intended as a flare to illuminate battlefields or as a smoke screen to hide the movement of troops. The U.S. military has used it in Iraq and Afghanistan against insurgent trench lines and spider holes where high explosives do not work. White phosphorus is not listed as a chemical weapon unless used against civilians. This is a substance that is fat soluble and burns spontaneously on contact with the air. It creates deep and multiple burns. If not deprived of oxygen, it will burn down to the bone. User-friendly words have been created to mask the brutality of this substance. During the Vietnam War, it was called Willie Pete or Willie Peter. These soft nicknames have been recycled for our present wars. What happens to us when we create a chemical called white phosphorus, which sounds like a kind of Christmas, perhaps even a kind of snow, and we use it to burn alive both civilians and troops in hiding? And we don't call it burning. We don't call it murdering. We call it shake and bake. That's the military slang for what white phosphorus does. Shake and bake. Entry point for a writer? Well, this is it for me. When I was growing up in Kentucky, shake and bake is what you did to a piece of chicken. You put a raw chicken breast or wing in a plastic bag that contained a handful of a few delicious smelling spices, and you gave it a good shake, and then you baked it. It was called shake and bake chicken, which all of you know. How have we allowed our language to be twisted and rejigged so that the shredding and burning of women and men in Iraq, in Palestine, in Pakistan, and other places, spaces, and eras is akin to preparing and baking chicken? Or the brutal deaths of Afghan civilians, such as in the village of Azizabad, where U.S. troops recently killed 95 people, 50 of whom were children, none al-Qaeda, are dismissed with the myth that they were all militants. Or the predator drone strikes against Pakistan, a country with which we say we are not at war, that according to the conservative Brookings Institute kills civilians at a 10-to-1 ratio, the one being the ever elusive militant. The other credible source lists the predator kill ratio as 50-to-1, but the bodies of these men, women, and children have become non-bodies, unbodied, eviscerated first by remote control, and then again through a Western press that is more often in service of cover-ups rather than uncoverings. And this lie in the service of empire is replicated over and over, day in and day out, in our name, in our press, by our government, and on our stages and in our daily discourse. We must, I believe, disrupt the lie with an imagination that is fierce, demystifying, and persistent. We must meet the perversion of human intellect for the benefit of war and oppression with a creative force, a poetic force that challenges, interrogates, and disorientates. Or in more poetic terms, do as Keats suggests and be awake forever in a sweet unrest. Unrest. Yes, that's where the sweetness, the sexiness, the seriousness makes things happen on stage by speaking truth to that most inhospitable terrain of human thriving, global capitalism. This is all to say that we should aspire to be interested writers. Interest, a word too often hijacked by finance. The Latin prefix inter means between or among. It also means mutually together. Thus, interact, interrelate, and international, wonderful words and injunctions for writers. As if describing engaged and challenging writing, the Latin word interesse means to concern, be of importance, and, here's the kicker, to make a difference. break the word interest down, it basically means inter, between, and esse, to be, to live between, to live between self and world, self and others, ourselves, our others, our histories, their histories. Sure, our stories are occasionally interesting, but what I'm talking about is connecting our everyday experience to a worldview, the big picture. I have a photograph of Angela and I when we were about 7 years old. We are standing beside a small pond on my father's farm. It's summertime in Kentucky. I am holding a goose. My arms are the arms of a seven-year-old, but I am clutching the goose in a way that says, "Look at me, I am holding an enormous bird all by myself." In a few minutes, we will release the bird, and according to my father's plan, begin the stocking of the pond with ducks and geese. Angela is standing next to me. We're both in our shorts, our skinny legs like exclamation points beneath us. Angela is holding on to the goose's foot. She's got a tight grip on it and smiles at the camera as if to say, "I may not be holding the whole goose, but I've got a piece of it." I call this photo, "Who's Holding the Goose?" because in it I can see already the fissures and fractures of a society that grants power and grab and hold to those who are white and own ponds and the water in those ponds and the power to prove it. Of course, Angela and I weren't thinking of that this day. I held onto the goose my father had put into my arms. Angela took the foot. And in spite of the rules of ownership, Angela created in this photograph her own presence, her right to have and to hold. The myth of free enterprise is that we are independent of one another, that we flourish in the me, mine, and myself. But ultimately, we are social beings and we need each other to understand ourselves and history. The stranger at the door is there so that we may realize that the stranger is also us, that hospitality on the stage and off the stage is what enriches, challenges, haunts, and articulates our lives. When we cross boundaries, when we violate our own skin to know the heartbreak or hope or resistance of another, what we come closer to, surprisingly, is ourselves. Because through imaginative empathy, we revive our own humanity. So, to put it simply, we must be where we are not, because if we look down, we will see that we are already there, here, among those we are encouraged to believe are strangers, who are suddenly no longer strangers. Thank you all for coming today and being so hospitable.
This has been a presentation of the Kentucky Women Writers Conference and the University of Kentucky. We would like to thank LexArts, the Kentucky Foundation for Women, and the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning for supporting these endeavors. For more information, please visit KentuckyWomenWriters.org.